All right, guys. Well, first and foremost, welcome everyone to another exciting episode of the Black Tower Podcast, a Wheel of Time podcast. I am one of your hosts, Daniel.
And I am another one of your hosts, Josh.
And we are joined
and unfortunately,
in
the third
spirit
member
here.
In our trifecta of taintiness is not with us tonight. He's doing something lame called traveling home for the holidays. What a weirdo.
Ew.
Anyway, we are super excited to have you guys here tonight.
Indeed. And as said, we have Andrew here in spirit. He gave us his blessing to do another episode for you without him. So it'll just be Josh and I from the Black Tower. But. We have a very special event planned, and that is that we have some very special guests all the way from the other side of the world in so many ways.
Literally.
Mm-hmm. We do have some lovely gentlemen who have been kind enough to join us from the Blood and Ashes podcast.
I
am doing my best Andrew impersonation with my lack of being able to speak English. From the Blood and Ashes podcast, which is a super fun new-ish podcast that I discovered a little while ago. They are super funny. They are three mates who do a podcast about the Wheel of Time, which they self-proclaimed read about 10 years ago. And so they are on a reread right now, and it is thoroughly enjoyable to hear them talk about things that they know to be true but can't remember, and certain things that they have no idea to be true but seem to somehow maybe kind of have an inkling about. So before we get into any and all of that, please introduce yourselves. We have two of the three members. Go ahead, guys.
Go ahead, Vili.
All right. I'm Vili. I'm in Melbourne, Australia. And I know absolutely nothing about this book at the moment, and it's a brand new adventure for me.
And I am Mo. I'm in Sydney, Australia, and I am the third leg of the Blood and Ashes podcast, which Daniel so accurately described as three middle-aged dads who basically remember nothing. Which does not allow or does not give us permission to stop just speculating wildly and then in the very next episode having to correct ourselves, which has become a cornerstone of our episodes, really, is we start off each episode with corrections for the previous.
That's funny.
I think that's a fantastic format. Just throwing that out there. And no, it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that we ourselves commonly have to put corrections out. Totally not at all.
Literally about to say that. I think that I think Andrew has read the series twice all the way through. You've read it like three or four times. And I think I'm on like reread number, I think I just finished reread number five.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, and literally, end up going through the entire thing, being like, "Yeah," and then this definitely happened, and then this definitely happened in this book. Yeah. I remember
this is not
it well.
The Mandela effect that happened,
and then like literally the next episode, because we again have lovely people on our Patreon, especially who are our wonderful fact checkers who go, that's not when that happened, and that's totally wrong, and then we start the next. Next episode with cool. So I was wrong about this thing.
But I mean just to cut straight to the heart of it, the reason we started the podcast in the first place is because we all wanted to reread the series before the show started on Amazon Prime, right? So I mean us and half the world. And what I remember is 90% of the fun of reading the books is talking to your friends about it.
Yes.
You know, like even on the first read, like speculating and just talking and even being wrong, like that doesn't matter. Like it is just fun to talk about it. So we've turned that into a feature of our show is we speculate wildly. We don't hold back at all. I mean, I'm through morbid curiosity listening to our earliest episodes again and just I'm saying things with just utter conviction and
reckless
100% certainty.
I have.
And then in the next episode having to just completely pivot
back. I have never once listened to our previous episodes and gone, oh shit. I have never once done that.
No, the answer is Josh has actually never done that because he's never listened to a previous episode.
Why you gotta attack me like this?
Once it's done, it's done.
Totally. So we openly invite the audience. We openly invite the audience to participate. That is the whole point. Like, we don't mind being wrong because we want it to be a conversation not just between the three of us, but with all of our listeners as well. So, like, anyone that writes into us is pretty much guaranteed to get a mention on the show.
So if anyone is looking for a good time or for some happiness or just a good chuckle, go check out the Blood and Ashes podcast.
Yes.
Because they're a bunch of really super cool dudes. And we're super excited to hear your particular perspectives on tonight's topic.
Indeed. But speaking of
tonight's topic, I like how in sync we are there, buddy.
Right? Indeed. I think that we actually, before we talk about this topic, I don't think this is going to be a full series necessarily, but to be safe, we do definitely want to throw on some protection for all of the people listening, because this might get into some stuff. So before we actually do the spoiler warning, just to let you guys know so that you can sort of know yourselves, tonight we are going to be talking about the White Tower and its resolve in the books, and a lot of what goes on in that. So there is going to be a little bit of a wide berth of topics and things that we're talking about. So definitely to be safe, if you have not read all the way through the series, you do have a chance that you will be spoiled on something.
It's true.
And definitely, if you have not read up until, I would say book 8, you are guaranteed to be spoiled from something on the book. So definitely be aware of that. Slide on your spoiler condom as far down as you need it to go. As I said, definitely 8 inches, probably all the way to 14.
Oh, I was about to say only 8?
I said definitely 8, probably all the way down to 14. But yeah, this is viewer discretion advised in some ways, because I don't 100% know how deep we're going to get, because we might not get all the way to the end of the series, because let's be completely honest, there are aspects of the White Tower that do stuff all the way to the end, but the White Tower itself doesn't actually do stuff all the way to the end.
Yeah.
But anyway, there you go. You have been warned. Please be aware of that. But
so we're gonna say like a level red up to book 8 and a level yellow past that. But
I would say
technically at its very basic form, this is a spoiler for the entirety of the series. Because we're not discussing a specific event and or topic and or character. We're discussing the White Tower as the subject of this particular episode.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's some good conversation to be had here.
Yeah. So we're actually going to start sort of right off the jump, right out the gate. And we're going to talk a little bit about what the White Tower is in the beginning of the book series. What is their purpose? What are their goals? And sort of how are they put together? And I would love nothing more than our two guests to go ahead and put together, you know, basically just kind of a general synopsis of who the White Tower are and what they're doing at the beginning of the series, especially because you guys are actually kind of at the point where you've just gotten the White Tower defined in some ways. So take it away, guys. Go ahead and let us know if we have anything to add. We will do so, but I think you guys probably have this one covered. So who are the White Tower, and why do we care?
I should copy and paste our little spiel from our show into yours now to say feel free to interject and correct us at any time. But you're right. Like, I mean, we're on our show, we are about a third of the way through the Great Hunt. So, I mean, we just finished The Eye of the World a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago. And you certainly, you get a view of the White Tower as a whole and as an entity, maybe even only really at the beginning of the Great Hunt. I mean, the only Aes Sedai you meet in the Eye of the World are Moraine and Elida. And when you meet the Amelin in Faldara, and she's brought, you know, her representatives from each Aja, and she actually has a massive just exposition dump in the beginning of that book about, like, you know, all the issues she's having within the tower and stuff. The Hall openly challenging her ability to leave the tower in the first place to go to Faldara. You get the sense in the first book that, you know, the White Tower is this larger power, and this, you know, essentially what it is, a puppet master pulling the strings of, you know, the royalty around the world. Especially again when you are introduced to Elida, and you get a sense of, you know, Moraine's relationship or lack of a relationship with Elida. And then
they don't like each other.
What?
Now they're best mates. They're from the
White Tower.
They're
sisters. I thought they were sisters. Yeah,
they're like this.
They call each other that. But then at the beginning of the second book, it quickly becomes obvious that, man, these guys are. There are so many competing agendas between the different Arjas, and, you know, including the Black Arja, who are very active already.
There is no Black Arja in Ba Sing Se.
See, for me, it's quite simple. It is a coalition government. That's what it is. It's like any government that's made up of multiple parties. And although they should agree when they face to face, they do not agree. They barely agree at all.
And that image of them as a unified front is quickly shattered by the time you're a couple chapters into book two. It's like, okay, this is a dysfunctional household.
I love it.
Well, and let's go, just for fun, let's go back a little. I think that's first and foremost, a great description. I don't even have anything to add to what they are at the beginning of the books. Let's go a little bit further back and talk a moment about how the White Tower was formed in the first place. Basically, after the breaking of the world, there were a bunch of little pockets of Aes Sedai who were all just doing their own thing.
What the hell do we do now?
Yeah, kind of the world was completely different than the one that they grew up in. The world was completely different than, you know, the one that they had known. And all over the world, there were these, you know, small groups of women who could change or who could channel and who were, you know, together. And this one Aes Sedai walked around the entire world in some ways and gathered them all up and said, all right, cool, we're all going to build something on Vagina Island, and you guys are coming with us.
Yeah.
And it's almost, in some ways, once you find out how, like, the origin story of the White Tower, it's almost fascinating that they're still one entity by the time you hit the Eye of the World,
right,
in the first place.
They would be reeling from their own members. I mean, the male Aes Sedai that went mad and broke the world were Aes Sedai. And you still see the ripple effect of that in the Eye of the World, where everyone just, you know, lumps them all in together. It was the Aes Sedai that broke the world. Yes. These women would have had to face that reputation. Thanks, males.
Right. Thanks, Obama. I mean,
thanks, Obama. Thanks, Dragon.
No, I think that's a really good point to state that, you know, we always hear about, you know, organizations and clubs and businesses and things that ended 100 years ago, like they don't even exist anymore. But then you've got the White Tower and the Aes Sedai, and they're like, no, we're going to be a beacon of light to the world forever. And it's like, yeah, sure, that's what everybody says. 3,000 years later, the Aes Sedai, the female Aes Sedai who have survived, are still pulling pulling strings and playing politics, and are essentially one of the most powerful political forces in the world.
I would argue
the only thing that I can say will contribute to that and make it be what it is the fact that they age so slowly.
Yes.
So well.
I mean, that could be part of it too.
This is one of the things that I've always thought was an interesting parallel in D&D, in high fantasy, there's always the elves. Mm-hmm. When you talk about Lord of the Rings, when you talk about, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, when you talk about all of this, and there is that idea of long memories, long lives, and a different perspective on the world based on the fact that the lifespan is so much more extended. And so in the Wheel of Time, you do have a race that is like that with the Ogier.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have these people who again, it's like half elf kind of thing where they are humans. So they have that impulsiveness. They have that, you know, that human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they also live for at least twice as long as a normal human.
Right.
Minimum.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, some of them, you know, the canon and whatnot can live like four times to five times the length of a normal human. And so it is, again, it's that fight between human nature and the desire to do things now.
Yes.
And also that perspective of...
They're so hasty.
Of, you know, actually being able to see so much history as it was made. Not hearing about it in village tales, not having the village council tell you about the history of your village and your town and your nation, but literally having lived through a good deal of that history and what that does to you. And so definitely on one hand, it's fascinating that the White Tower is even a thing given its origin. And given how much they scheme against each other, and given just how much infighting there is between the Ajahs and between individual sisters and between everything. And yet there's also this sense of, but they understand, at least some of them, in fact, typically most of them, actually do understand that, you know, together we are stronger.
Do you think
even though they don't like each other very much, the majority of them are like better as a tower with 12 different strings than 12 different towers, each with their own string.
So that's that is not the lasting impression that was impressed upon me. So, really? I mean, I have read the series twice, and now I can say through the haze of time and memory that what I remember of the tower is the division.
Yeah.
More so than the common goal.
Sure.
I'm eager to be proven wrong during my reread, because I'm so desperate for them to work together. Because, you know, the amount of time that you swear at them, you know, through the pages for being fucking idiots is...
Right. Right. Well, and
probably
to be
the
fair,
thing that keeps them together in that tower is that all the cool toys are kept in the vault there. And if they bug off and do their own little tower, they're gonna be like, oh shit, we got none of those cool toys.
Yeah.
Damn it, we gotta deal with all these sisters. Goddamn
toys. Yeah. No, and to be fair, I do totally agree, but it's also a little bit unfair to go ahead and talk about in this story, because there is it is a breaking level event kind of thing that is happening in the world.
Yeah.
And so you're right. You are absolutely right that what defines the tower in the story is
and also
the breaking and the Saladar Aes Sedai and the White Tower and the sort of coming out of the Black Aja and the, you know, or the revelation of the Black Aja and the taking down of an Amyrlin and things like that. And so I completely agree with you that in these 14 books, the White Tower is more defined by their division. than their oneness. You are 100% correct.
Think about it like this too, though. Despite all of that,
mm-hmm.
despite their many terrible choices, they were still able to put forth a ridiculously amazing showing at the last battle.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
truth.
The White Tower came ready for a fight.
Yeah.
Like, in all aspects of the fight, they were like, okay, you guys are going to go over there and fuck shit up. You guys are going to stay back here and heal the people who got fucked up.
Yeah.
You guys are going to go over. I mean, like, they were ready. They were there.
The tears of fuck.
Despite
that the White Tower was able to heal.
Despite all that. And, like, I've got to say, damn.
Yeah.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangsta. Like, the White Tower has been the most gangsta organization around for the past 3,000 years.
You're the most gangsta around.
Yeah. No one's ever gonna take them down. And there's all kinds of fan theories about, you know, Moradin being alive in the world, or Ishmael, as he's known, being able to touch the events in the world for the last 3,000 years. There are fan theories that the Oath Rod, you know, we learned that the Oath Rod limits the lifespan of the Aes Sedai, limits their abilities. So there's fan theories, and I don't know that they've ever been confirmed, but there's fan theories that was inspired and or orchestrated by Dark Friends, led by Ishmael, to weaken the White Tower. There is fan theories that are not confirmed that the separate Ajahs have been played against each other because of the Black Aja, who wants to weaken the White Tower. And 3,000 years of this type of erosion, and damn, if they still didn't show up with a big stick at the last battle. That's like,
good point.
I mean, absolutely. God, they did so good.
They weathered the storm.
And they did it well.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't want to take away any credit to them for what they did in the last battle. Because again, you are right. There is no denying what you're saying. I will also throw out there that they had kind of a dope Amyrlin at that point, who had been through a lot and kind of went, my whole purpose from being made Amyrlin to now was this moment.
Yeah,
you're not wrong.
But you are correct. They did some cool stuff. And to their credit, I have to throw out there that one of the things that they don't get bashed enough for in the division is all of the Aes Sedai that stay in the tower under Elida. Yeah. And yet what they don't get credit for enough is all of the women that fell in line and decided that the White Tower was more important, the Aes Sedai were more important,
yes,
that the last battle was more important when Elida is removed.
True.
And so, honestly, that those Aes Sedai who are able to pivot like crazy.
Some might say flip-flop.
Are they flip-floppers?
Adapt, improvise, overcome.
That's a nice way of saying it there, buddy boy.
No, but again, it is, to their credit, they do really turn the tide of Tarmin Gaiden.
That's true.
And you couldn't do it if they dug in their heels and said, okay, well, maybe you're the Amyrlin now, but we're not going to help. Maybe you're the leader of the White Tower now, but not my president. Like, that kind of thing. And for the vast majority of the sisters in the tower, when things actually do pan out, when things do actually end up going the one way rather than the way they expected, they do actually turn on their heel and jump in feet first.
Isn't there an obligation through everything that they've gone through from novice to an accepted to becoming a full Aes Sedai, going through all that tests, that there is that one bit in you that burns just a little bit more, unless it was removed when you joined the Black Archer, saying like, okay, I'm fully turning against all of you. I'm having this removed out of me. And regardless of the splits between the different Ajahs, that they still have that one burning desire that we have to pull together. And that's maybe why they stuck on, like you so elegantly said, the Jaina Island for so long, that there was that burning desire just to, all right, it's gone to 3,000 years of living with the same roommates, and it might be the shining walls, but goddamn, I'm fucking over this now. And it sort of starts breaking a little bit at the seams. But when the shit happens to go around them and they realize that the other houses are even more dirty, they said, okay, fuck, let's pull this together. Let's do this thing now.
I am so over quarantine. Leaving Vagina Island, and you can't take my rats from me.
Now, Dan, you mentioned the Oath Rod. What can you remember? Because I mean, this is now way ahead of where we are in the books at the moment. Sure. But what are the oaths? Because I remember in Swan's sort of exposition dump in the beginning of The Great Hunt, she talks about, or someone mentions that the Aes Sedai are sworn to follow the Amerlin.
Yes.
Is that sworn on the Oath Rod, or is it just
is an oath that they take, but it is not. Okay, so they're not bound.
There are three oaths. There are three oaths that they take.
Can't lie.
They comply, obey, and obey. No, they take oath number one is to never speak a word that is untrue.
Yes.
Which is all kinds of fun. And that's the one that people focus on the most, because that's the one that I think they have to deal with the most.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's one that they will never use the power as a weapon.
Unless, in order, it's actually to speak no word that is not true, to make no weapon with which one man may kill another. And then the third is exactly what you were just talking about. Never use the one power as a weapon, except against dark friends or shadow spawn, or in the last extreme defense of their own life.
Okay.
Those are the three oaths. And to be fair, yes. I would actually say that while the first one is the one that permeates the story the most, I would actually say that the third one is the most important.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they should make more swords, though. Come on. Power of weapons. It will really help them at the end.
I was trying to ascertain whether there is some kind of one power obligation born from the Oath Rod that sort of, you know, helps to keep the tower together under the Amerlin seat, you know, as long as there is an Amerlin seat to follow, if there's anything binding them to that, but there doesn't seem to be. So
interestingly enough, there is, but it's not one power bound, because there is definitely something that happens that you see sort of once when Elida is made Amerlin. And then again when Egwene is made Amerlin, that there is actually oaths that are taken, but they are not one power sealed.
Well,
which is the difference between the Oath Rod and just a really powerful oath.
They're just on page one of the Aes Sedai handbook.
Yes, exactly.
They are in a certain sense, though. Because when you swear on the Oath Rod to speak no word that is untrue, and then you pledge unquestioning fealty to someone, you must be sincere in that oath, which means you cannot act against that oath.
Now, you guys got it all wrong. They've all been duped into it.
Oh, really? We've got it all wrong. See,
no, please.
This is how it went down. 3,000 years ago, when they made that shiny white walls, they said, you know what we should do for the future woman that's going to live in this place? Let's stuff them over. Let's make it an Angreal that if you live in these walls, you have to obey. You are compelled to to act as one, irrespective of your hate of men or your love of orders or your love of the books. You all have to do it together.
Is a Terron Greal.
Oh my God.
This is the kind of out of the box thinking that we have Vili on the podcast.
I love that. Oh my God.
So Malkier Talks, Rob, you have a theory podcast. I need you to dive into this. I need you to analyze this immediately.
Oh God, does that mean that the Black Tower is also going to be an Angria or a Terron Greal?
If it's not, it fucking should be.
But now that also now makes sense why Moraine is never the fuck in the tower. She's like in there for a few days. Like, I gotta get out of here. I'm feeling obliged.
I need to get out of here.
Well, and it's why Cad Swain never feels any obligation. She's been out of the White Tower for 400 years.
She's quote retired.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man. No, I like that. I don't think I will throw out there that I don't see any evidence of it in the books specifically, but that is new canon. I like it.
I'll go with that.
Becoming new canon.
Yeah. So okay,
regardless
so
of evidence
power,
or lack thereof, it's
who
canon.
Needs evidence these days? You just act on how you feel and call it good. That's cool.
The White Tower is definitely a Terron Greal.
So the walls of the White Tower are a Terron Greal that are constantly compelling people to behave. What are the
walls Merlin, of the Black walls, Tower? The walls are calling.
Are the walls of the Black Tower compelling people to be aggressive?
Whoa.
I'm just asking.
I mean, sort of. It's just compelling you to have machismo.
Yeah, and to be brooding.
Yeah,
and ominous
the Black Tower are they're a Terron Greal inspiring toxic masculinity.
Boys will be boys.
Yes, we did it. We solved it, guys.
It's the reason that it's been torn
on the Black
down
Tower
and
podcast.
Rebuilt so many times because they haven't gotten the right
walls.
They haven't gotten the right formula for the machismo walls yet. No, cool. So we talked about where they started and things like that. So once the tower breaks, what is your, I'd like to hear sort of your opinions on the sisters who stay and the sisters who go. Because obviously in the story very much we are pro Saladar. Both, you know, all of the women we
bold
like.
Bold assumption, Dan.
Okay, sorry. I you're right.
But it is
I
correct.
Say that. You know, you are pushed towards in the story, you know, being for the Saladar Aes Sedai, all of the main characters are aligned with them. They are aligned with Rand in so much as you can be. You know, different things like that. They don't try to kidnap him. All of these are reasons that you would be sort of aligned with the Saladar Aes Sedai. Over the others. I'm not saying just in general, because if you're aligned with Aes Sedai, period, you're a dumbass.
The problem is, though, is there's a really important moment that shows the folly of the Saladar Aes Sedai.
Oh, there are like five or six, but which one are you talking about?
The specific one I'm referring to is when Egwene comes back to the tower and they hold the ritual to make her the Egwene.
To make her the Egwene.
Mm-hmm.
The most Egwene of all the Egwene.
The most Egwenest of every Egwene that has ever Egwened.
No, to make her the Amarillin. In the White Tower, physically inside the White Tower.
In the Shining Terron Greal wall.
One of her first things to do is to be like, okay, I will accept the apology of the Saladar Aes Sedai. And Swan's like, the apology? What are you talking about? And Egwene goes, they are rebels. They rebelled against the White Tower. They broke the law. I will accept their apology. I will be nice to them and accept them back with open arms. But I do not have to. I could have them executed for
treason. Did she stand in the mirror and apologize to herself? I really want to see that moment before she goes up. Egwene, she's like,
I apologize to you for rebelling against me.
Because really, you should have gone back to the White Tower instead of Saladar. But instead, you went to Saladar. But anyway, so, you know,
from what I remember, Egwene is very much committed to the whole idea of the White Tower, right? And being whole for the last battle, because she knows a split tower is gonna get their asses handed to them.
House divided against itself cannot stand.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's that. I mean, you brought that up in the context of folly, you know, from the Saladar Aes Sedai. But I quite respect that in Egwene, that she can openly admit that she was part of a rebellious act that needs to be... I mean, they are now entering back into the fold of the White Tower. So there needs to be some kind of acknowledgement and admission of, you know, deviating from it in the first place.
Well, and again, I do think that that is kind of a brilliant move in so many ways, which is one of the reasons that from the point when Egwene is actually made... Actually, I would say from the point that Egwene admits her lie to the Wise Ones on, I actually really like Egwene. That point, she has a tendency to be really obnoxious. I still like things that she does, but she does have a tendency to be pretty obnoxious. But once she actually does that, is really the trajectory of just like mostly just upward Elaine.
Refresh my memory. Which lie does she admit to?
She tells them that she is not an Aes Sedai.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. She admits to them that she lied to them about being a full Aes Sedai and that she is actually just an accepted.
Right. Okay.
And that is when, because there are like four or five that she also could admit that she chooses not to, because she just chooses the big one. Yeah. But.
Yeah.
But going into Teleran Riad when she's not supposed to, not actually following all of their instructions about when she's sick. Yeah, she has like at least four that I can think of off the top of my head that she just doesn't admit to them. But yeah, the admitting that she wasn't an Aes Sedai and that she lied to them and that Moraine let her lie is the one that they beat her for.
Yeah,
I know this is not an Egwene deep dive, but I mean, since we're talking about her and Saladar, was there, I know that when Swan was sort of coaching her to be an Amyrlin before she's sort of made Amyrlin in Saladar.
Correct. Yeah.
Swan is coaching her, right? And then they raise her to Amyrlin.
That is after.
Is it after?
Because they actually make her Amyrlin on the day she arrives.
Oh, wow.
Because she literally goes into Teleran Riad in bodily form,
right?
Rides Bella to Saladar,
leaves
Teleran Riad in bodily form. They're really surprised to see her, but then they have the conversation the night she arrives and they raise her Amyrlin for the rebels the next day.
Right.
And then then she switches gears on everyone and she sort of drops a facade, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, okay, now I'm here. Now, doesn't she claim like war powers or something and can make unilateral decisions?
So the problem is that when they raise her, they think, ha-ha.
Yeah, she's a puppet.
A willful little girl that we'll be able to use as our puppet and shield in case this doesn't go well.
She plays up that persona.
And she does.
They didn't listen to book one and two.
They were not from paying Innisfield. Attention at all.
They're from the Two Rivers. They are as stubborn as absolute fuck.
You do not get
to bend them.
The saying was they could give lessons to stones in how to be stubborn.
Exactly. Just tell them to kneel and see what happens.
The rebel Aes Sedai had been smart, they would have gone the Spaceballs route and just watched the video of the Amazon Prime series for season one and had known that Egwene was a terrible choice.
Well, a terrible, but she was the best terrible choice, though.
No. A terrible because choice for their purpose.
For them.
Yes. A terrible choice.
So not only is she stubborn.
To achieve what they were attempting to achieve.
But she's wicked smart, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's adaptable. And that's, I guess that's her like big character attribute that everybody loves, is how adaptable she is.
She also has a super strong rebellious streak. I mean, in the very first book, and I mean, I'll be focusing on the first books because those are the ones we just read most recently, but you can see from the beginning, she is saying, Nynaeve is still young. She's going to be a wisdom forever. I'm going to go do something else. And when everyone is about to leave, she just rocks up and says, I'm coming with you. You know,
she's like,
she's not timid.
Yeah. She's aristocracy of the Two Rivers. She's the mayor's daughter.
Yeah.
So if she's a priss or a snobby little girl, it's because she's aristocracy or as close to it as it gets in the Two Rivers.
Well, and also, again, she's so a contrarian. It's 100%.
Yes.
You tell Egwene she can't do something, she will figure out a way to do that. You tell Egwene she's not allowed to do something, she will do that thing more.
Which
Perrin
is
Perrin talks to her about
awesome.
Not dancing with Aram.
Yeah,
she just goes and dances with Aram more.
I'm now starting to think that that morning after Winter's Night and when everyone disappeared, and Bran was standing there saying, oh, my daughter's gone. And then he went, sort of wiped some sweat off his brows, like,
I don't have to deal with that anymore.
No, honestly, the scene where he goes to meet with Egwene and Elaine, and Egwene tells him that she doesn't love him, you know that on some level, Rand was just like, bullet.
Okay. Cool.
I thought I was basically arranged marriage with this woman for years.
Yeah.
But now I'm free of that.
So, but as far as the White Tower goes, like even when they were drafting Egwene to be the Amarillin, they had to know that she would be powerful enough. I believe that they thought, okay, she's powerful enough to make this look like a legit decision.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But we, in our arrogance, are powerful enough to control her still. And they were kind of, that was sort of an arrogant thing. But there's still the foundation of understanding there that this is a person who's going places.
Yes.
This is a person who has extreme ability to channel. Mm-hmm. Extreme ability in their power of will.
Mm-hmm.
We can work with this. We can do this.
Yeah.
And it's a big enough prize that we're going to look like we're serious, even if we have to sacrifice her in the end.
Well, all of her good character traits, you just mentioned there so nicely, Josh. Isn't that just traits of being Taviren?
Oh, my friend, we have just touched on something we've discussed in tremendous detail.
Yes, and for some reason, for whatever reason, whether it was just too many Taviren in one place, Robert Jordan does seem to make the conscious decision to never actually call Egwene or Nynaeve Taviren. Yes.
And so,
at the same time, they do very Taviren.
I wonder,
like Taviren tier stuff in the books all the way
through. So here's the problem.
You're absolutely correct that those traits mesh very, very well with Egwene being, at least on the same tier, if not actually a Taviren.
Yeah, I mean, their early interactions with the Forsaken, where they sort of like blindly, you know, fall through like serious confrontations, is pretty impressive.
Yeah,
and the thing that gets
unbelievable.
Me, I have to wonder, because we've not really discussed this as well, but the reason why they're such powerful in Emmons Field, I think a lot of people dismiss it as, it's old Manethrin, right? They're like, oh, Manethrin, and the blood of Manethrin sings, and the blood of Manethrin is strong.
What's Manethrin?
Your mom.
But I have to say that I think that having not one, not two, but three Taviren in the same place, plus having the blood of Manethrin, you have like attribute stacking at the highest levels to create Egwene, Nynaeve, Rand, Matt, Perrin, even, and then all of the other, like Bodwin Cawthon, all the other like women that they recruit from the Two Rivers, I feel like is a sort of, so they don't have to be Taviren to be affected by Taviren and to be enhanced by Taviren.
Well, and to be fair, that's actually one of the things that I was about to say, is that if you look at Tam Al-Thor's life, if you look at his exploits, which A, since I know that Rafe Judkins and most of the producers for the Amazon series listen to the podcast, I'm just going to throw out there, if you end up doing a spin-off series of The Wheel of Time, the very first one you should do is Tam Al-Thor's prequel.
No.
His entire life is amazing.
No. The very first spin-off series needs to be The Black Tower.
No, that's the second one.
No.
Starring Josh, Daniel, and Andrew.
Thank you. The second spin-off series you can do will be Tam Al-Thor.
Fair enough.
Swordmaster, Blademaster, and Soldier.
But again, it's also one of those, you know, interesting and age-old questions is, when does your Taviren nature start? Does it start when you're a baby? Is the reason that Tam Al-Thor's life was so amazing and he was led to go ahead and pick you up on the slopes of Dragonmount when you were born because you're a Taviren? Or because he's a Taviren?
Well, Tam had a pretty... I don't know, we're veering quite wildly from the White Tower
never do that.
We've just had an explanation from Moiraine at the beginning of the Great Hunt when she tells Rand and the Amyrlin Tam's history. So she gives a bullet point list. And I mean, Tam's exploits are
ridiculous. Yeah.
Second captain of the companions for Ilion, you know, like part of the elite fighting troop that would have been thrown into the hottest battles, fought in two wars with Tyr, became a blade master, another war with the White Cloaks. And then as, you know, one of the companions being thrown into the most heated battle against the Aiel, who are, you know, the most deadly killing force in all existence. To walk away from that is...
Oh, not only to walk away, but to walk away with a present.
To walk away with one of their Yara Khan.
To walk away with their leader among leaders.
Their promised one. Oh, I'll have that. Thanks. I'll take him to Yeoman's Field.
I feel a Mandalorian reference coming on.
I love it! Right. Well, okay.
This is the way.
Do not get me started.
I won't. Because I actually haven't watched the most recent episode. So please don't go in.
No. I'm not even talking. When it comes to Star Wars, with particular references to this, there's just a whole lot of rabbit holes that I can go down. So we need to focus on the Wheel of Time. Mm-hmm. But Tam, as a soldier, like, impresses the hell out of me. I love it. And I think his story is so believable and plausible. And I do look forward to, and I hope that the TV series is going to give us flashbacks.
Mm.
You know, some sort of references to Tam Al-Thor, the soldier.
Mm-hmm.
As to why a farmer in the Two Rivers should have a power wrought Harren Mark sword.
Yeah.
Because he didn't just have a Harren Mark blade. No. He had a power wrought Harren Mark blade, which, like, that's another echelon of mastery, I think.
We already know that one of the characters cast in the show only appears in A New Spring. So there is grounds for some flashback mechanic.
Mm. Well, and no, I definitely think that the idea, and this is one thing that, again, I feel like we're done with our discussion, and now we're just veering off course, and it's great.
Now we're just fucking around,
right? In the show, they've already talked about the fact that they are at least going to attempt in some ways to make it more about Moraine being the main character in season one at the minimum. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I think is admirable, though I have no idea how they're going to do it, is actually 100% trying to convince you during season one that Rand isn't just obviously the Dragon Reborn. To have it be a question as to whether Matt Perrin or Rand is the one she's looking for all the way up until the end of season one. And as I said, season finale.
Yes. Shit. Whoa. Season finale. Knocking on wood. Season finale.
But yeah, it is definitely that does lend itself more to, you know, given that New Spring is almost exclusively Moraine Lan and other this characters one. Therein of Moraine's early life. I definitely think that there's a high likelihood that there will be a number of New Spring flashback reference kind of things to, again, try and really cement that Moraine is the character we care about. The rest are people that we will care about later.
Moraine!
And that at the end of season one, you know who you're following from here on out, but that season one is Moraine.
Mm-hmm. Season and that's one the thing.
It should be. I agree.
I think that's a valid sort of progression or character a building technique.
Yes.
Is you have the wise mentor who you care about teaching and passing on that torch to the true hero of the story. I think
Obi-Wan Damodred? What
will be interesting is how in the books you have it the other way around. You have a lot of point of view from Rand, and Moraine is painted as you can't really trust her because Rand doesn't trust her, and rightfully so. But in the show, you're not going to have those point of view perspectives. So
it well, and that's the question. I hope you do. How are they going to do that? Because I don't know whether they're going to, because there's no way that you can't, as far as I can picture it, I can't put together in my head any kind of imaginative way of not including Rand and Tam going back to the farm and getting attacked by Trollocs.
Yeah.
And then Rand dragging Tam back to Emmons.
You would have to. You have to.
Yeah.
But in the problem therein lies is that you don't get a similar scene from Matt. You don't get a similar scene from Perrin.
That we know of.
In the books.
Is
what I'm saying.
In the books.
And so again, you now have to have the question of, you're already talking about 14 books where you are going to have to
I see where you're going with this.
Ridiculous amount of content from the written word of the Wheel of Time to the show of the Wheel of Time. And so adding in scenes of Matt and Perrin to be comparable seems like a hard direction to go. But at the same time, again, I'm really excited to see how they do it because I have a lot of faith in Rafe. I do actually have a lot of faith in the Amazon team. And honestly, you know, Sarah Nakamura has talked a lot about this on Twitter. Rafe has talked about this a lot on Twitter. You know, Yosha and Barney and Marcus have all, you know, done their own posts about like different things about the show. And I do have a lot of confidence in their interest, ability, and intent on making season one really good. I just have no idea how it's going to happen. And that's so exciting.
Yeah.
But yeah, cool. So last thoughts, just sort of generally White Tower. I know that we've
going back 20 minutes. We've strayed a bit from the path.
But last thoughts on sort of, I'll go first, just sort of in what I mean on generally the White Tower. I think that they, you know, one thing that we didn't talk a ton about, but we've definitely talked a lot about in our episodes, is that the entrenched knowledge of the White Tower is really problematic. And they are fighting 3,000 years of tradition. Which actually ends up meaning a lot to the sisters in the White Tower, because on so many levels, it's what holds them together. Mm-hmm. Because again, they do have those long memories. They do have that long lifespan. And if you don't have routine, if you don't have tradition, if you don't have rules, then 250 years of living is crazy and kind of balls to the wall. Yeah. And so I do give... We're really hard on the White Tower here at this podcast, and for good reason.
But well, you're on the Black Tower.
Right. But I do think that they do deserve more credit in some ways than we necessarily give them, because
absolutely,
in the written pages of what we see, they do turn it around. And they have so much habit and so much tradition and so much... you know, knowledge base of what can and cannot be done that just gets thrown to the wind during the series. And while, again, I definitely think that they as an organization should never have gotten entrenched in those knowledges, I do think that by the end of the series, they are one of the biggest, most impressive pieces of the forces of the light, and they have learned a lot between page one and page, you know, and the last page of book 14. And so I definitely admire the resolve of the White Tower, even if I don't
absolutely
always appreciate or admire
absolutely
the, well, it's undeniable, right? Ultimately, of the they White are successful. Tower.
Yes. Exactly. Right?
Despite the fact that there is massive infighting, is a massive schism when Saladar breaks off. And let's not forget that the Black Tower or the Black Arger is like firmly entrenched. In this is a silly example, but like in the first part of the Great Hunt, the girls are traveling to the tower for the first time. And every night they're visited by a different Aes Sedai to come and coach them. The first one is Varen, Black Arger. Yep. Then it's Leandrin, Black Arger. Then Elviarin, Black Arger. It's like,
damn, are, you're not wrong. Holy
they
shit.
They are in the mix. And isn't, I mean, I could be wrong here, but isn't Mesaana also like,
oh my God,
in the White Tower itself?
Yes.
Like posing as a sister? Yeah. Like, I mean, there is some serious rot. And
well, and Lanfear is also in the tower for a certain amount of time. Yeah,
posing as Elsie Grimwell or something, right?
You're pretty sure
I'm dead right
that,
now. You right? guys have just, oh!
See, and this is why we need fresh faces. Because seriously, end, I had forgotten that the first three freaking sisters.
Right? Holy shit!
We've just read that, so we have an unfair advantage.
Good Lord!
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah. No, I completely agree.
And then ultimately they are successful.
Yes. There is so much going against them, and yet.
Their resolve is purely like they have their culture and they have their own personalities. Their personalities drive the Black Arger. It drives the division. But the culture of the Aes Sedai is the thing that is their resolve. That culture of just being able to, despite all of that, still somehow keep it together, even though there's such factions from every spectrum of the rainbow all the way to the unseen light and the black, that they still hold it together.
Yep.
It's true.
It's very true. Josh, what do you think?
It's lovely.
It's
wooden teat.
be lovely.
The White Tower is a beacon of light in a weary world. And their power is not based on their ability to channel or based on their ability to manipulate, you know, political comings and goings. Their power is based on the ability to overcome attacks by the Dark One. And if we, or not even necessarily from the Dark One, but to overcome the attacks from people who have different ideas on what their role should be, i.e. the Seanchan. The White power, Cloaks. Yeah, the White Cloaks. I mean, the power of the White Tower comes from the fact that they say, we have one purpose, to stand against the Dark One. We all have different ideas on how that should be accomplished. And there's a lot of, like we need to talk about, there's a lot of infighting. There's a lot of division. And it even leads to a broken tower and rebellion in some cases because people have different ideas on how they should stand against the Dark One. But what gives them their foundation and their true power is that all of them can stand united. Well, except for the Black Aja. And I think that's something that Egwene gives them as a common enemy. Mm. Is that they're able to say, we stand against the Dark One. The White Tower is a bastion of light, a beacon of light to hold back the darkness. And I think that all the attacks against the Aes Sedai over the years, all the attacks against the White Tower, all the erosion, all of the little things, the little, you know, chips away at the resolve of the White Tower, I think it's still very impressive that after 3,000 years of constant strain, they are still able to, in the last moments, granted, in the last moments, in the very last moments, they're still able to go, you're right. We need to unite against the common foe. And it does not take a lot of work for Egwene to come in and go, we're divided and we need to not be. And at first everybody's like, oh, you, what do you know? We are divided, but how can you teach us anything about that? And then Egwene's like, watch. And then like 2 days later, everybody's like, oh,
don't believe me, just watch.
Egwene, you are so right about everything. You should be running this place.
Egwene did hard work when she was to the White Tower proper and basically made a novice again and, you know, set to scrubbing pots and stuff. I think I said that in a recent episode of ours. That is probably my favorite, you know, stretch of the story. Yeah. Is Egwene.
Yes, Egwene back in the White Tower is pretty fantastic.
Applying her Aiel training to, you know, accepting pain and stuff. And Swan makes a comment in the beginning of the Great Hunt, just to go back to that again for the 100th time. But she makes a comment to Moiraine that, you know, if they are caught, you know, with this scheme of theirs to find the Dragon Reborn, they would be exiled. But Swan wouldn't be exiled. She would be stilled and kept in the tower as an example, meant to scrub pots and floors, because nobody can rally behind a woman scrubbing the floors and scrubbing pots. And then Egwene goes in.
Oh, contraire, mon frere.
Yeah. It is my favorite part.
That is, again, this is one of the reasons that I really appreciate getting the, you know, people who are at different points in the story, because you get those moments of the way that Robert Jordan ties everything up in a fantastic bow.
Yeah.
Of that's such a throwaway line.
It is. And it's in book two. You know, it's like the foreshadowing is vast.
Yeah.
There's multiple entries in the series before that becomes a reality.
Yep. And you're just kind of standing there kind of fascinated that this man could think that far ahead. And are just anyway, it's amazing.
And it's the kind of thing that you would only pick up on a reread. Right?
Right? Like,
exactly. By the time you get to Egwene going through that stuff, you forgot about that throwaway line from Swan in the Great Hunt intro.
It's true.
Yeah. But
man, so good.
This has been great. I've had a lot of fun. I hope that you guys listening have had a lot of fun, and I hope that our guests have had a lot of fun. But unfortunately, it is now time for us to be done. And to say goodbye. But before we do, definitely want to go ahead and again, thank you very, very, very much to our two members of the Blood and Ashes podcast who were able to join us for the evening. We appreciated your insights. We appreciated your humor. And we appreciated your all of your references to The Great Hunt. but before we say goodbye to you guys, definitely we would like to let the people know where they can find you, because as I said, I think their episodes are super fun. They are super funny. You can tell that these guys have known each other for a good long while and have a solid amount of history with each other, and that shines through in all of the best ways in their episodes. Where can the people find the Blood and Ashes podcast?
Well, as you said, Blood and Ashes podcast, you should be able to find on any podcasting, major podcasting streaming app, Apple, Spotify, all of them. We've listed on all of them. We've got a website just called bloodandashespodcast.com, on which there's an embedded player if you want to go listen to episodes there. On Twitter, we're at Blood and Ash Pod. And on Facebook, we're Blood and Ashes Podcast.
Nice.
Perfect.
It's good that you got all those names.
The guy with the Twitter handle Blood and Ashes has not tweeted in 11 years, and I DM'd him to ask if I could have it, and I got
what
no response.
A dick. Time fan.
I was also going to say that if he hasn't posted in 11 years, then the likelihood of him getting the message that you were interested in.
Here we go. What we need to do.
It's pretty low.
Everybody listening right now, go out and follow Blood and Ashes on Twitter.
And then tag spam them in something. Everything in it.
Yes.
And just be like, hey, you should give your name to this podcast. Hey, you should renege on this name so that this other podcast can happen.
Spam the shit at Blood and Ashes. We need this needs
but
to happen.
To actually find the right podcast so that you can actually follow these gentlemen until they get that name changed again, it is Blood and Ash
Pod
podcast or pod
ash. Just Blood pod. And one Ash Pod.
Blood and one, Ash Pod. One Ash,
one single
one
ash.
Pod. One ash, one pod.
It's all very strange.
One ash, blood, one blood, ash, one pod. But yes,
that's the trifecta of their podcast. They have three people. One person is the blood, one person is the ash, and one person is the pod.
I'm so definitely the pod.
Is the pod person.
I'm the pod. If you go take a look at our website, there's a blog page with a single blog entry on it. And on there, I've got a photograph of the pod that I build from which I record, which is a blanket suspended over a dining room table. It's pretty amusing.
Fantastic.
Go check it out.
Fantastic. I like it. Well, again, guys, thank you so much. Definitely to all of those listening who are aware of the Black Tower podcast. Because you're listening to us. Because
you're
right
here.
And yet do not yet know about the Blood and Ashes podcast. Please go and listen. They're super fun. There's not actually that much to listen to yet, but there will be more in the future. So enjoy what's there and pay attention to more. As I said, they're good dudes. They're fun dudes. And
join the conversation. You know?
Yes.
Listen to our show and please do correct us. And I mean, I don't mean just for the previous episode. Listen to all of them. Make a nice long list of all the shit we messed up and then just let us know what they are so we can address it on the show.
Though I will make a recommendation. Watch the or listen to the first episode, then listen to the second episode. If there's something that's wrong on the first episode that they didn't correct in episode two, then write it into a post. You don't just going ahead and making a huge list and then sending it to them and having them be like, We corrected ourselves on like 90% of this. That's not that helpful. But
well,
yeah,
Dan, we've
the conversation.
We've corrected some of our own corrections. So
oh really?
And how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's the best.
That's true. Yeah. Oh God. All right. That's true.
Thank you so much, yes. Everybody, for listening. Thank you so much for tuning in. You guys are the best.
Indeed.
We love you.
And also to make sure that you guys know, if you somehow stumbled across this podcast for whatever reason, please go to blacktowerpod.com. You can find all of our stuff on there as well.
YouTube,
Run Naked
Twitter,
through the forums,
Patreon, Google,
all of that different stuff. And there is also, as they said, an embedded player on our website as well. So you can find the other episodes that you may have missed on there as well. So just go and do that. And then also, once you are done on Black Tower Pod, pop on over to thegreatblight.com. You can find everything. Wheel of Time there.
All the Wheel of Time thing.
So many content creators, and so many of them great. A wiki that is being worked on that is spoiler wiki, which is a fantastic idea that I don't know how never happened before. All of that good stuff. Nablus is doing a great job over there. And last but not least, if you would like to go ahead and find your own Shining Walls Terangrials that will make you follow the Omerlin until the end of your days, you can go to facebook.com/rockpick. Or go look up The Crystal Barista on Instagram. She is lovely. She does lots of stuff. She is one of the sponsors of our podcast. Go buy some shiny click clacks from her. And if you think they have special powers, then awesome. There are lots of those as well. You can get a Red Rod Terangrial and all of that good stuff.
Sweet.
If you want cool. one.
If you want one, if you're down with that kind of thing. But yes, again, thank you so much to our lovely guests. Hopefully we will actually get to talk to your third member at some point here as well.
It was two in
the morning when we asked them to go ahead and hop on where their third member was. So unfortunately that did not work out today. But we will see about going ahead and getting all three of you on at some point as well. And hopefully Andrew can be on there as well. But from all of us here at the Black Tower Podcast, I have been Daniel.
I have been Josh, your Sorovan Maher.
And from Mo, from Willie, and from Andrew here in spirit, we all want to wish you a very happy holidays. It is now past Thanksgiving, even though we're recording this before Thanksgiving. but have a lovely rest of your week. Have lovely holidays. I hope that you stay safe and see as many of your family members as you safely can. But from all of us here at the Black Tower, I hope that your morning is going awesome. And in case we don't see you again, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.